So, my goal for tonight's Dharma talk is to keep it a little bit shorter than normal so that we can have some time at the end of class to kind of wrap up the course. And I want to allow enough time for anyone who wants to share to be able to, since this is our last time being together in this course. And as Carol had mentioned earlier, Meg is going to be joining us in just a little bit. She is on the Insight Santa Cruz board, and we are in the middle of our annual fundraiser, our fund drive, and she is the head of that committee. So it was very important for her to be there at the meeting tonight. But she will be joining us at the end because I would also like to invite Carol and Meg to put their voice into the room and if they have any final thoughts on this course. So if you've been here for the past few weeks, you know that we've been talking about the four Brahma-Vihara practices. And we started out by practicing metta, or loving kindness. And this is the practice of generating those feelings of warmth, love, and well-being, and directing those well wishes to ourselves, to our teachers, our benefactor, to our loved ones, to the neutral people in our lives, and even the difficult people. Of course, this practice isn't just limited to human beings, but all sentient beings. And that's actually true with all of these Brahma-Vihara practices. We then learned about karuna, or compassion, and this is the practice where metta meets suffering. So when we see a child fall down and skin their knee, or when we or someone we know loses a loved one, it's not running away or hiding from or whitewashing that uncomfortable feeling of suffering. It's actually facing it and meeting it with love and care. And then there's mudita, which is appreciative joy. And this is the practice where metta meets happiness. So if we see a child laughing as they play with a friend, or when we or someone we know has something really great happen to them, it's not meeting it with jealousy or envy. It's meeting it with a shared happiness, that feeling you get when you see someone's happiness and it just makes you happy. That's mudita. And then there's upekkha, which is equanimity. That's what we are covering here tonight. Now, mudita, or appreciative joy, this might be one of the most difficult to practice, but upekkha, I think, might be the most difficult to explain. So I'm going to do my best here. And just like everything else in this practice, upekkha is something that should be practiced and experienced on a personal level. So hopefully this can provide some understanding or wisdom of what upekkha is, but it's up to you to experience it for yourself. In Buddhism, we often talk about the middle path, which is the way that the Buddha described his practice, which led to his enlightenment. So before the Buddha was the Buddha, he went by the name of Siddhartha, and he lived a very pampered life. He was a prince. And at 29 years old, when he was finally exposed to the suffering that aging, sickness, and death will bring to everyone, not even the wealthy and well-protected can avoid those things. When he finally figured this out, he decided to dedicate his life to learning about suffering and how to not suffer. He knew that living a life of comfort and fulfilling every desire with pleasurable experiences wasn't the answer. He did that for 29 years, still suffered. So he decided to go the opposite route. He tried several extreme practices, from basically self-torture and starvation. And he realized that this also is not the way to end suffering. So he lived both extremes, and he still had suffering in his life. So he decided to land somewhere in the middle. He wouldn't cling to anything. He wouldn't push anything away. He would simply be with whatever arose and would meet that experience with curiosity, with kindness, and with letting go. And this is what he referred to as the middle path. And this path is what leads to equanimity. Equanimity is central in the Buddhist practice. I've heard equanimity explained in a number of different ways, but in a one-word answer, or I guess it's a hyphenated word, but it's even-mindedness. So another description that really resonates with me is equanimity is a calmness in a difficult situation. So when the shit hits the fan, we can still keep our cool. We don't get lost in the thoughts of our minds as they try to spin things out of control. You know, we're able to kind of keep our cool with whatever is happening. And the same can be said for the opposite of a difficult situation. So equanimity is calmness in a pleasant situation. So we don't let our ego take over. We don't let it go to our heads. And the Buddha urged his disciples to cultivate the ability to see things clearly without being caught in them. The word that the Buddha used to describe this was upekkha. Of course, the Buddha didn't speak English. Upekkha is a word from the Pali language, and it is roughly means to look over. So this gives us the sense that equanimity as a quality of observation without getting too involved. It's seeing with understanding and with patience. It's a skill that allows one to remain involved in the world while maintaining a sense of detachment and peace. Remaining involved, okay? That's important. It's not ignoring. It's not an aversion to experience. Equanimity requires us to be up close and personal with the pains and the pleasures. With equanimity, we become less reactive and can see more clearly. And I think my favorite way of describing equanimity came from Gil Fronsdale, who is a semi-local teacher. He's up there at Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City. And he also has the Insight Retreat Center here in Scotts Valley, which I highly recommend attending a retreat there as soon as we are able to do that again. Anyway, Gil describes equanimity as a grandmotherly love. And he goes on to describe that quite often when you have a set of parents who are going through the parenting experience for the first time, and maybe some of you have even gone through this before, they tend to be very sensitive, you know, maybe taking things a little too personal the first time around. So for example, small child, we know they're going to say just about anything that comes to mind. You know, they're also very emotional, and it's not in a bad way, you know, at least most of the time, but they just express whatever is present for them. No filter. So one minute they may tell their mom, you know, mommy, I love you. I love you. I want to marry you. You know, and then the next moment they may say something like, you know what? You're so mean. I hate you. And some parents will be so attached to these words and their hearts will just explode with love one moment and then ache with pain the next. But grandparents, they've already been down that road. So they have the practice and the patience and the experience of knowing how to hear those words without overreacting. They might just respond with, oh, okay. So when the kid says, I love you, Grandma, I want to marry you, it's like, aw, thank you, sweetheart. Or, you know, when the kid says, I hate you, Grandma, you're so mean, it's like, oh, I'm sorry you feel that way, dear. You know, it's a very steady, very, very calm way. They aren't tempted to go down either road. You know, they keep on that middle path. They're keeping their cool. I just love that description. It's very understandable to me. So as I mentioned, equanimity is central to Buddhist practice. It can be found on several Buddhist lists, including the four Brahmaviharas, the seven factors of enlightenment, the 10 paramis or perfections. And what's interesting is it often shows up last on all of these lists, which kind of illustrates the importance in the Dharma. It's the teaching that ties all of the other teachings together. So how does it work with the Brahmaviharas? Well, as we've talked about, the Brahmaviharas are known as these heart practices. And I like how there's four of them because it reminds me of the four chambers of the heart. In order to be healthy, you want all four chambers of the heart to be functioning properly, right? And in this practice, to have a free and liberated heart, we really need all four Brahmaviharas to be functioning properly. You know, not just as a meditation technique, but something that we can come to see as an everyday, every moment thing. So when I look at these Brahmaviharas, I see loving kindness, compassion, and joy. Those all make perfect sense to be included as a practice of the heart. You know, you can almost feel a quiver of the heart when you're practicing these. But then there's equanimity. How does this qualify as a heart practice? You know, and honestly, for the longest time, I couldn't understand how it fit in. It's like that game, one of these things is not like the others. Equanimity, it's often misunderstood, and therefore it's left out of a regular practice. And I'm including myself here. I'm totally guilty of doing that. It just didn't seem as important to practice as the other three. But in reality, I just didn't understand it, so I just ignored it for most of my practice. So as I mentioned earlier, metta is loving kindness, karuna is compassion, where the metta meets suffering, and then mudita, the appreciative joy, is metta when it meets happiness. So upekkha or equanimity can also follow this pattern. So equanimity is basically just metta plus insight. It's a love plus an awareness of impermanence, non-self, and just an overall awareness of the intrinsically unsatisfactory nature of our experience. It's a combination of love and insight. And that's what makes upekkha a Brahmavihara. You have to have that love as part of the practice. It's a support for the other three. So I imagine sitting here with my heart exposed as I practice the other three, right? Where we're sitting here and it's super vulnerable and where the heart's just breaking wide open for those first three. And then I imagine upekkha as my support from behind. You know, so as I'm opening up and being vulnerable, here comes equanimity and it just kind of like straightens me up and supports me, keeps me supported during these times of vulnerability, keeps me steady. As with the other Brahmaviharas, equanimity has a near enemy and a far enemy. The near enemy is a quality that looks a lot like equanimity, but it's not wholesome, while the far enemy is the opposite quality. So the far enemy of equanimity is greed or attachment, which is easy to understand. The near enemy is indifference or apathy. This is important. You know, equanimity implies that there is a level of caring and presence, unlike apathy. So we want to find ways to support equanimity. And the Buddha taught that seven qualities of the mind that support the development of equanimity are integrity, faith, mental capacity, wisdom, a sense of well-being, insight, and freedom. And there's a metaphor about salt water, and I think it actually works really well with equanimity. So if you take a tablespoon of salt and you put it just into your standard size glass of water, the salt taste is going to be pretty obvious and perhaps even overwhelming if you try to drink it. And if you take that same tablespoon of salt and you dumped it into a huge lake, the salty taste wouldn't even be detectable. So the more space there is, or the greater the body of water, the less the salt will affect it. Equanimity is an act of creating space. It's allowing things to be and making room for them. So when life gets salty, we have enough room to not let it be so overwhelming. With equanimity, we can explore the aspects of the mind without having to worry about getting caught up or taken away. It's how we learn to let go. It's what will lead to the end of suffering, to enlightenment. And cultivating equanimity is traditionally done through a formal meditation practice, and really it's what we've been doing this entire time. You know, when we've asked you to allow whatever arises in your meditation practice to just be there, you know, allow it to arise, allow it to stay, allow it to pass. This is training ourselves to be with the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral without overreacting or getting lost in the experience. Because we know that all things are impermanent, and we know that letting go is the only option if we don't want to suffer. So I did say I want to keep this short, and I think that's all I really want to say about equanimity. Again, it's one of those concepts that if you don't fully understand it after the first time hearing about it, or the first 5 times, or the first 50 times hearing about it, it's perfectly fine. It's something that you really, I think it's beneficial to look for it, to start beginning to practice with it and see what's there. Be curious about it. It's just like any of these other practices. We just need to be aware of it. First step is just becoming aware of it and then seeing what our experience is around it. So we're going to want to open up for questions and comments in a few minutes, and we can definitely keep the conversation going. But for now, let's just sit for a minute and allow ourselves to settle back into the present moment.